You're listening to the Golf Unfiltered Podcast, your source for in-depth interviews with the biggest names, brands, and personalities in golf. Our mission? To keep you informed and help you enjoy the game even more. And now, the owner and host of the Golf Unfiltered Podcast, Adam Fonseca.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Golf Unfiltered Podcast. I am your host, as always, Adam from GolfUnfiltered.com. You can follow us all over social media at Golf Unfiltered, and you can send us an email, golfunfiltered@gmail.com. Go out to iTunes and rate us 5 stars. If you like what we do here on the podcast, be sure to leave us a comment as well, because we take all of that feedback very seriously. And of course, before we get into today's show, I want to say hello to our friends over at thehackersparadise.com. If you're listening to this on the THP mobile app, hello to our friends over at Cleveland and Srixon Golf, really enjoying the new Z-Forged irons. Just so pure. Just loving hitting those every single time I go out to the course. And of course, hello to our friends over at budgetgolf.com. Go out to budgetgolf.com, take a look at all the great things that they got going on, all the great sales. Get your game in gear, literally, for the warm weather. And finally, here in Chicagoland, we have had a pretty good stretch of weather. Had the chance to play golf over the weekend with a few people, including my friend and tonight's guest, Mr. Michael Verska. He is a return guest. He's been on the show a few times, and listeners love him. Listeners love to ask questions of him. And today we are going to talk more about golf equipment, but specifically about how golf equipment is tested, not only by websites like ours and others, but also by original equipment manufacturers themselves. And it's really interesting, some of the topics that Michael and I go into today. And I hope that you find that they're educational as much as they are interesting. And there's just so much that goes into making sure that the products perform the way that they need to perform for a brand before they actually get to the store shelf. That's probably something that we take for granted. We probably don't even think about that. But something that's been coming up on social media lately, and it's, I feel like a lot of these shows stem from what I read on social media, which is fine. I mean, I'm on there all the time. And of course, a lot of you send me emails as well to talk about certain topics. But one of the topics that keeps coming up is the concept of whether or not the testing protocols that some websites do is adequate enough or not to distinguish whether or not there's a significant difference between two clubs or between two golf balls or between two golf products that everyone can go out and try and buy. Not too long ago, I actually wrote an article that appeared on our website talking about statistical significance. It's in a new weekly feature that we're going to roll out called Unfiltered Friday, and it's going to really run the gamut on different topics. And so it's not always going to be about nerdy statistical things or testing protocols. But as I've said a few times on the show, you guys know that I work in that world in process improvement during the day when I'm not saving the world talking about golf. And one of the things that I do every day is I help my organization improve the way that they do business by, well, for one, training others in the methodology that I follow, but also actually working on projects and designing experiments to actually see, hey, did we make a difference or did we just make a change? And I feel that that really translates well into the whole golf equipment testing and review space, especially recently, when some pretty high-profile testing results have come out, specifically about golf balls. Then, of course, other websites focus on other products. And yes, even us at Golf Unfiltered, we do some very high-level testing and reviews of equipment that really touches more on how we think that the equipment feels, how it works well for us, and never to tell you whether or not you should buy something. Now, there is a big difference between making a switch just because you have a preference and you want to try something new versus making a change in anything, whether it be a business process or a new piece of golf equipment, because you can tell that that will actually improve your game in this instance. And in the article that I referenced, I write a little bit. I guess that's the appropriate way to put it. I write a little bit about this concept of statistical significance. And Michael and I talk a little bit about it today in our conversation, so I won't spoil that. But I do want to say that I am fully aware that some of the things that I mentioned in the article, as far as how you should design an experiment adequately so that you have a big enough sample size and that you can go ahead and make sure that your reliability and your repeatability, you know, all of that is sound, and that's, you know, established really well. I go into all of that. I understand that that all costs a lot of money. I know that if I were to do that for Golf Unfiltered, or me and my team here at Golf Unfiltered were to try to do anything of that nature, we would need the funding to do that. I'm not going to go and drop thousands of dollars to establish a design of experiment that's going to not only ensure that the randomness of the samples are protected, but also to make sure that the results that come out are tried and true, and all the variables that you can think of, whether it be fatigue for the person hitting the golf ball, or changes in the weather that may impact the way that a golf ball flies. All of those things have to be controlled, and that does take a lot of resources that, quite frankly, I don't have the time, nor do I have the patience, nor do I have the means to go ahead and design that. That's not a cop-out. I hope it doesn't come across as that, because I don't want to sound like a hypocrite either, where I write this article saying, hey, this would be a better way to conduct these experiments, and then in the next breath turn around and say, well, you go ahead and do that. Because then I would be like other websites. And I think we know who I'm talking about. At any rate, the point being here is that there are many differences in golf products that, whether or not we know it, they exist. And what I'm talking about specifically is manufacturing tolerances. Any product that you buy off the shelf, off an assembly line, if it's touched by human hands, there are going to be differences from one to the next, even if it's the exact same product. Now, I know when we're talking about something like golf equipment that's designed by machines and you know, CAD machines and artificial intelligence, if you're Callaway, for crying out loud, human hands, human interaction is very minimal, or at least it's decreasing over time. There's still going to be some variance in the design from one product to the next. And so Michael and I get into all of that today. We also talk about why that matters and why you should care about it as a consumer and how that can impact your game depending on the type of product you buy. In some instances, depending on the actual lot or the item off the assembly line, like I said, it all depends. So Michael Verska and I get into that very deep here in just a second. We will be right back after a quick word. Let us know what you think about today's discussion. Sit back and relax. Here we go.
Hi, this is Bill Hobson from the Four Golfers Network podcast. And as you and I enjoy this episode of Golf Unfiltered with my friend Adam, I'm reminded of an indisputable reality. We, as golfers, are nuts. We chase a small ball around the planet, spending thousands of dollars in the effort to get that ball into a tiny hole. We then yell at the ball and curse it when it doesn't listen, even though it can't listen, it's a ball. This insanity is all part of the magic of the game, and it's what we celebrate on the Four Golfers Network podcast every Monday when a fresh episode comes your way on Apple Podcasts, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeart, you know, all the places. So after you finish listening to Adam today, I'd love to have you check out the Four Golfers Network podcast, that's F-O-R-E, where we celebrate the game with top name guests and an exploration of the things about golf that both drive us crazy and bring us back for more.
I stink! The ball is just sitting there and I can't hit it!
Welcome back, folks. As I mentioned, we are happy to welcome back Mr. Michael Verska for the 700th time on the Golf Unfiltered podcast. Michael, it's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. I think this is 698, though. Oh. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. But always happy to be here and talk golf.
I'm always good, plus or minus two episodes. It's just really timely for what we're going to talk about today. a lot of talk about product testing, equipment testing. Obviously, there's been some pretty high profile tests and results have been circulating throughout the golf atmosphere. But, you know, just to remind our listeners, you worked in the golf industry and in many ways continue to do so for many years. And you are an engineer by trade. And so it would be safe for me to say, I think, that you've seen your fair share of product testing. Am I right?
I have set up, run, conducted, managed more tests than I can possibly count over the last almost 20 years now of golf time. So, yes, and, that is something I have some expertise and knowledge in.
And you approach it not only from the perspective of watching a new product leave an original equipment manufacturer's back door, but you also come at it from the perspective that you've designed golf clubs, correct?
Absolutely.
And as part of that whole process of design, there's a lot of testing that goes on. There's a lot of metrics that you have to keep track of. Give our listeners a little bit of background on the typical testing approach, even at a high level, when a new product is being designed, when it is being tested before it reaches the store shelves. What does that look like? Is that a fast process, or is that something that takes quite a while?
No, it's a fast process in the sense that we're trying to go typically through multiple tasks, but it's a slow process. Obviously, you want to limit the variables. And typically, if you're let's just take a set of irons, just to make it simple here. Mm-hmm. What you typically do is you're going to test a long, middle, and short iron, and then you're going to pick out four or five, maybe six, eight at the absolute most, of the products that you think are both market leaders and that you're trying to compete against, or you think consumers will want to compete against. So it would typically be your last products. You're going to compare your last product to your new product. And then, if you're not the market share leader, what is the market share leader, or what the clubs that, are selling well that you want to compete against? Almost never would an OEM test 20 different sets of irons. It's just not what is needed, right? You're not going to contest a blade versus a Super Game Improvement product. Mm-hmm. So, the first thing would be to get in that group, and then just what are the key, clubs that you want to compete against, whether maybe it's, maybe you're worried about losing a tour player if it's a better player or a blade. And, your tour, you heard rumors that, Company X is going after one of your tour players. Want to make sure I've got the data to understand how we can compete against that. So there's lots of different reasons. But usually you're trying to narrow the field to the most important clubs, and then go right after that. And again, if we're just talking about irons here, mm-hmm. Long, middle, and short irons. You'd have a standard setup of whatever that be. And usually that includes, some sort of a test club that you use as a setup. Hey, well, I'm going to set up the machine to launch club X always at this launch angle, at this ball speed, at the spin rate, and I'm just going to put the clubs in and see how they compare to that standard club. The other way you might do it is say, okay, hey, we believe, through player testing, that this new club that we're testing, which is the center of the test, if you will, has a 26-degree launch angle and 6,800 spin rate. So we're going to manipulate the robot to get that equip what we've already found mm-hmm. from player testing. So there's at least two different, but those are the main two ways you would go about it. Is do we want to replicate the launch and spin and ball speed we've got from player testing, or do we want to make this a standard test where we're going to get something, a known element, and then compare everything to that known element?
That's interesting. And so when, regardless of either path you go down, how does an OEM decide, I guess, what to market? Because I think there's a lot of misinformation out there, Michael. You and I have talked about this, about, is there truth in advertising? Is there truth in marketing? I would imagine that there's some thought, a great deal of thought, that goes behind, all right, well, to use your example that you just outlined, two iron sets from a manufacturer, the most recent versus the previous model. Does an OEM try to focus on certain characteristics that they want to improve on based on customer feedback? Or how does that work, that they can actually say, we made a longer club, or it's a more consistent
sure.
club?
Well, and this comes into where marketing is. I don't mean this in a negative way. I think too many golfers hear marketing and they throw their arms up and say, something bad's about to happen. But what do you want to market? Are you marketing this as a longer club? Are you launching this as a higher or a higher launching club? Are you launching this as a more forgiving club? And you'd want to pull out test data that highlights that feature, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing, and one of the things I think that consumers, when they think about OEM testing, again, let's go back to my fictitious example where we're testing the new club against eight clubs. That doesn't mean that we're going to put all eight results out for the world to see.
Okay.
You know, we are going to most likely pick the three or four that we do best against.
Sure.
Or pick the three or four that, again, highlight. Again, maybe we're saying that, you know, we think a superhuman improvement needs to launch higher. That's what our data is saying. So, you know, we may only compare it against, and we may only show the launch angle. Hey, we launch higher than our old club by 1.2 degrees, and we launch higher versus X by, you know, the competitor X by 0.8, competitor Y by 1 degree, and competitor Z by 1.4. So that doesn't necessarily mean that it was even the highest launching in the whole test, right?
Hmm.
So, and I think that's where sometimes consumers think that, oh, you know, I read this marketing and they're lying. I have never worked for a company that would flat out lie in that regard, period, that would fudge numbers. But again, there's the truth and there's the whole truth, right?
Right.
So I believe that people are telling the truth. Again, everything I've been associated with. But that doesn't mean I have to reveal every result that I have from that test data.
Right.
There's a very famous test, and I don't have it in front of me, so please, if I don't have this where I'm going off memory, but there was a test about fairy woods that were claiming 17 yards longer.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people probably remember that. But if you read the fine print, I think that was, you know, one club against one other club with a very, very, very limited number of golfers.
Hmm.
And so people, if they're curious, can go look that up themselves. That was a fact. Again, the two clubs they were testing for this limited golfers, they probably did get 17 golfers. Now, again, I wasn't there. I'm not saying that this happened, but did they test 40 golfers and pick the three that was the biggest difference? I'm not saying that they did because I don't know. I wasn't there. But that wouldn't be lying. That just might not be telling the whole truth. They were telling a truth. So I think that's one of the things that consumers get confused. I really do not believe there are any golf club companies lying. Maybe I'm naive. Mm. I've worked in several. There was no not lying in that regard in the ones I worked for. The people I know in the industry are generally honest people. So, but that doesn't mean you present everything.
Well, and that's basically marketing, isn't it? I mean, let's just take it.
That is marketing.
I mean, that's any business you go into, you're going to have those half truths, I guess you could say, and that's probably even being unfair to the profession itself. I mean, my wife is a marketer, and I can guarantee you that she doesn't put out all the data from her company either, and there's a very strategic reason for that. But we do see those types of data being shown all the time. I can think of at least three recent driver releases, for example, that have shown charts comparing their new driver to others that were just released, and theirs is always at the top of the list. And I always find that funny.
Yeah.
Because the next one will come out and that same driver will be a few notches down. That's pretty much what you're talking about though, right?
Yeah, and again, and especially with robot testing, and to be clear, I'm a big fan of robot testing. I think it has a place. I'm also a huge fan of player testing, so I really believe there's important places for both. But you can manipulate results. Let's take a look at a driver, for example. Let's say that you've got a driver that's all designed and done, and you have to launch it for a number of reasons, right? You've announced you're going to launch it, but you get to the end, and all of a sudden you find out, for example, let's say it's launching low.
Mm-hmm.
So you run your standard test, and you go, oh my gosh, this driver's launching low. We're shorter. So do you go tell the market, hey, we're launching this driver, it's not very good? Well, the answer to that's of course not, right?
Right.
So what you would do is you would adjust the launch angle on the robot, continue to move the ball forward, change the angle of attack, whatever. There's many ways to launch the ball higher. It's the same as a golfer doing a robot, until guess what? This new driver you're launching suddenly launches higher.
Hmm.
Well, if you put all those other clubs that were launching higher, guess what? They probably launch too high now, correct?
Correct.
So when you put that data out, suddenly your driver is the winning driver.
it's
might have had to manipulate a standard test to get there. Are they lying? Absolutely not. Will they produce the results? I mean, there's you know, fair advertising claims, and if people really wanted to go through, they could probably get the test parameters. You know, I've worked at companies that had been questioned by other legal things where we had to produce, hey, this is how we set the machine up. This is exactly how we ran it. You all stop there, you know, because we're willing to show how we got there. We're willing to show the setups and the results, and away we go. But again, there is real R&D data, which is, I would usually say, not manipulated, but there can be marketing data where, again, my low launching driver example, which is not lying, 100% not lying.
It's so interesting.
You wanted to win.
Yeah. Well, and you're right, because you can set up any test parameter-wise to kind of give you the results that you want. And
that's the thing, right? And again, not trying to harp on robot testings, but one company's versus another company's versus another company's standard setup can be vastly different. Mm-hmm. And none of them are incorrect. That's just their standard setup. So that's the other thing, right? There is no true standard setup. There's just what company X wants to set it up, and that's how they always do it. They can get very different results from company Y using their standard setup because their standard setup's different. The ball's 2 inches further back or higher or whatever the case may be.
So from a consumer standpoint then, what are we to believe? Who should we listen to? Go
get fit. I think I've said that in the last couple of these. Go get fit.
I think you have. Well, and it's funny too, because you touched on the fact that there's no standard testing protocol or parameter. But I know, you know, you and I have had conversations about, all right, well, there should be at least some thought that goes behind, especially for independent golf sites like Golf Unfiltered, for example, you know, where we want to go and we want to do some reviews. Now, we do our reviews a little bit differently. We talk more on a personal side where it's how it performs for us. But if you wanted to go out right now today, if you and I went out, got a bunch of drivers on the market, and we wanted to do a test, I mean, we'd have to put some thought behind the design of experiment, wouldn't we?
Unquestionably, yes.
And that is probably the same amount of thought, and even more so, for these companies that are producing these products that they know are going to be reviewed by other sites, by other people, by the consumers themselves, because you can't go into a PGA Superstore without a ball launch monitor. I mean, that's even a club fitting, as you mentioned. You're going to see the data, how it performs. And if it's different than what's being marketed, they're taking a risk by anything that they put out there.
Unquestionably, yes. And I think launch monitors and, you know, places like, you know, PGA Tour Superstore with all their bays and, you know, competing companies like Club Champion and all the great work that they do, you can go in and find out if that driver is right for you. You know, and I think I think there's nothing wrong with looking at marketing and going, I find this marketing intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's supposed to do. As an educated, if you want to be an educated consumer, that's all it should be. This is intriguing. I want to go find out for myself.
Now, there are other reasons why a product might perform differently than advertised. And I'm speaking more in regard to the whole concept of manufacturing tolerances. Now, over, you know, recently on social, and you and I have chatted a little bit along with our buddy JB about just the difference in manufacturing tolerances from one company to the next. And, you know, this is a concept that I think isn't talked about enough, especially among average golfers. Now, just at a very high level, to kind of level set here, Michael, what is the definition of manufacturing tolerance?
So in any manufacturing process, there's going to be things that cannot be controlled within a certain spectrum. So again, let's take something simple like loft. A cast iron or a forged iron, doesn't really matter the manufacturing process, is going to go through a series of steps. And even at the end, two things that were right next to each other in the assembly line went through the exact same processes can have different lofts. You know, maybe the metal, you know, maybe when it was cooling, either again from a forging or from a casting, maybe it was a little bit farther on in the cooling area, or maybe it was a little closer to where the cooling fans were, and it just cooled at a slightly different rate. You know, it could be just a couple degrees that we're talking here could affect that. You know, there's so many things that go into it, so many steps that it's almost impossible to pinpoint that. Now, there's people whose literally their entire jobs is to minimize those tolerances. But, you know, the golf industry as a whole has really kind of settled into this plus or minus 1 degree for virtually all clubs. Now, you know, and I was reading one of the forums recently and somebody posted, well, they could just make it, you know, 0.1 degrees and, you know, and they'd have to scrap a lot. Well, that's kind of true, but it's kind of not. Can you accurately and repeatedly measure loft to 0.1 degrees. So it also comes into your measuring tolerances, which is something that, quite frankly, no one should think about if they want to, you know, if their goal is to break 80 measuring tolerances, it should be about 10,000th on their importance list. But if they are, these things go hand in hand. How repeatedly, what kind of repeatability do I get from, again, let's just look at lie, loft. What kind of repeatability can I get from my loft machine, and how does that factor into my tolerances? So, again, the standard in the industry for virtually everything. Now, milled products are a little bit tighter. So putters, you could maybe take putters out. But virtually everything else, milled putters, you would leave cast putters in. But but virtually everything else is plus or minus 1 degree. And even the ones who have really tight tolerances, you're talking, 0.6, maybe 0.7 is really the tightest that I'm aware of. Now, maybe there's... I have no idea what PXG is doing. Obviously, they charge significantly more. Maybe they've got something I'm not aware of, but I would be surprised if anyone is, again, below that.
Well, one of the things PXG is doing is sending Pat Perez a new driver, and I said that. Michael didn't say that. So people who watch on social know what I'm talking about. But you mentioned something that was really interesting, too, about just the difference in measuring tolerance as well. So it's not just the product itself, but it's also how it's being measured. And that's something that's very important. And I know you had mentioned that that might be the 10,000th thing on someone's list, but it's at least important to know that there are human beings who are measuring these clubs in a lot of instances, and golf balls or whatever. There are certainly a lot of machines that handle that as well, but there's always room for error is the point. And the reason I bring that up, part of our conversation the other day was that maybe you don't always trust what is stamped on a driver, for example. So if it says 10.5, in your opinion, Michael, how often is that driver really going to be 10.5 on the nose?
Well, so before I answer that, the first thing to recognize is it could be stamped 10.5, but if you got to see the engineering print, may say the standard is 11 or 11.5. or even 10 degrees. So there's the stamped, and then there's the engineering, and the world will never know what the engineering is. So having said that, with a good bell curve and a good manufacturing, you're probably looking at, 2/3 roughly of that, let's assume a 10.5 is the right number. You're looking at, 2/3 should be in that, 10.1, 10.2 to 10.7, 10.8 range. Now, I say that because if you gave the same person that same driver and told him to go measure the loft 10 times, that same person might get 10.2 to 10.8 on the same head just from setup and human error and repeatability.
Right.
So, it's not just, 10.5 or bust, again, because of the inherent nature of measuring a club that has two curvatures on the face, right? Both bulge and roll. To get that right, there's inherently some tolerance. But yeah, more often than not, you're going to hit that engineering. But again, I wouldn't be shocked at all to see 9.5 or 11.5, again, a certain percentage of the time, depending on the OEM's repeatability.
Now, so repeatability is one factor of it, reproducibility is the other. And so for OEMs, do they have multiple people kind of, quality checking themselves to make sure? Or is it just one person usually measuring?
Well, the answer is they have multiple. And I'm not trying to plug any company here, but sure, the bigger the company, the more dollars they have to spend, the more checks they're going to be able to put in, period. And quite frankly, the more checks they're going to have to put in because they're making more product, right?
Right.
If you're making 30,000 drivers versus, 5,000 drivers, there's going to be more what's called tools involved, the parts that make the head. Again, we could talk about this for hours, and we know we've joked about that. But you could buy a driver from company. If you go to a rack at a store that has 10 drivers, from one of the big companies, those drivers may come off three or four or five different tools. Now, the tool is the very basic that creates the wax that you put titanium in that becomes the club head. So even tools from one tool to the next could have slight loft or lie or or weight variances. Mm. So there are so many variables into these that people can head just spin around. So, you know, I guess what the most important thing is, go get fit, and you make sure you ask your fitter, did you check the things that mattered to you? Did you check the loft? Did you check the lie? Are you sure this is similar to the head I was fit on? You know, it's not unfair to, again, for drivers specifically, if you're not going to buy that driver, again, I don't think you need to. Have you checked the loft of this driver? Yeah, I understand that you put me in plus one on the hosel setting. But what did it really start at 9.5, or is this one that's 9.8 that really, you know, we really need to get closer to 10 degrees? So I think those are fair questions to ask in the fitting process. A good fitter is going to probably already have measured it and say, yeah, we've measured all these heads. We know exactly what they are, and we will match it up. So, again, that's kind of a long-winded answer that I think answered your question.
Oh, it did.
If not, you can – it's no. Your podcast. You can do whatever you want.
No, it definitely did. It kind of it brought up a few other questions, actually. So it was a very good answer, Michael. Good job. So another question that came up was, all right, well, I would have to assume – and I actually don't know the answer to this, but I would have to assume that those differences, even a degree difference, degree and a half, that's going to have some impact on performance, no?
Unquestionably, yeah. When you really get much more than, you know, I've always said, if you're an average, even above average amateur, you know, if you're a 5 or 6 handicap golfer, even, you know, once you get more than about a half a degree, 3/4 of a degree, you can probably say, well, you know, I'm a little concerned about this. But, you know, the people who go, oh, you know, this loft is off 0.2, I got good news for you. You're not that good. you know, unless somebody's going to give you a giant staff bag and pay you to walk around and actually pay somebody else to walk around with it next to you, that 0.2 or 0.3 is not going to make one bit of difference. Your consistency of angle of attack, your consistency delivered to the golf ball is not. But if, when you're talking a degree to a degree and a half, that is a significantly bigger deal that should be checked out. And again, a good fitter is going to take care of things like that.
And so to take that then and go back to kind of the marketing discussion, one of the things that we're seeing a lot more of, especially on social, are, and even at the PGA show when we went to it, are these independent companies. Now, you just mentioned that larger companies, of course, are going to have the bigger, you know, wallets to have bigger QC departments. These smaller companies, these artisan companies that are making everything, you know, quote unquote, by hand, which is may or may not be true in many instances. But I would imagine that, you know, well, they're priding themselves on the craftsmanship, and they're showing it off, and they're saying, hey, look how great the stuff is that we're making. Would it be a logical jump for me to then say, well, wait, how do I know your QC process is as good as, you know, a Callaway, a Titleist, or a TaylorMade? Or is that me just being a little too pessimistic?
No, I think, now, give me a second answer, because I know as soon as I'm halfway through this, you know, a bunch of people are going to go up in arms. There is no way for, you know, a 1 or 2 or 3 person operation to have the QC of a Callaway, of a TaylorMade, of a Titleist. You know, those companies literally have 40 or 50 people on the ground where these clubs are being made, not counting the people at headquarters who worry about it. So it's just not possible right now. The difference becomes the artisan, the 1 or 2 or 3 shop guys, they're probably checking the loft and lie on everything that leaves their shop. So maybe they don't have as good a QC coming in, but that doesn't mean they don't have as good a QC coming out. Again, if you buy a set of irons from a major OEM, they're not checking the loft on every golf club. They're assuming their tolerances are going to be good enough. If you buy it for, again, somebody who's a 1 or 2 person operation where they're only selling, you know, 5 sets a week, 8 sets a week, the owner of that or the manager of that is probably going to touch every set. So they might have time to check the loft and lie of every single golf club that leaves. So, I don't think it is fair to say that a major OEM has more QC. Unquestionably, they do. But again, that doesn't necessarily put the small guys, the conscientious small guys, the guys who are really into it and passionate, and if they're in the business, I'm sure they are. Again, they have the ability to, what I will say, catch up by looking at more details on every golf club.
Well, now I've got a really nerdy question for you, because where you just went to an area,
my favorite.
And being an engineer, you'll know what I mean by this, of course. And now what you just described kind of paints the picture for me about the benefits of a pull system versus a push system. And so for a push system, you know, the bigger brands are probably pushing out product, certainly to a in response to demand to a degree, but then and then some. Whereas the smaller brands, the guys that are, you know, the 1-2-3 man shops who are taking orders, creating those clubs made to order, literally, and then pulling them out. Is that where these smaller companies are going to really have a upper hand in some instances, depending on your point of view?
Yeah, and I think that's I think the answer to that is yes. Again, for those people who are hypersensitive, whether it affects their performance or not, it certainly affects their belief in their performance, that those small companies can. Now, having said that, that's why I think that, you know, so many of these really higher end fitters, the Club Champions, the Cool Clubs, the excuse me, the ones like that, you know, they you're getting that same situation, right? As that small shop, getting some, you know, highly trained people to touch it. If again, if you want a Callaway, let's just say, or a TaylorMade, if you go to one of those high end fitters, you're getting that same experience. So then you're getting the OEM and the individual, you're kind of getting a pull, right? Because you're not buying off the shelf. The shaft is different. The grip is different. The people assembling them are different. They're not coming in a box on a large boat or an airplane over a very large body of water. You know, they're coming in as heads only, and the shafts are coming from a different place. And maybe they're even frequency matching the shafts or puring or some other thing. So again, I think custom fitting is both the future and the present because of all the things we've talked about. You know, it's not, you can't just say, oh, my driver does this. Well, guess what, buddy? I'm getting on the launch monitor. I will see for myself if your driver does that. Hey, you know, I got fit for these. I can go right down to my local shop and, hey, I need you to check the loft and lie on these. So the way the golf market has evolved to me is so consumer centric now for the people who are willing to take the time and there's value in that and spend the money to get fit. You know, there is that benefit of that boutique end product from a big OEM.
Now, we haven't had the chance to play golf together yet, but at the time of this recording, we would have played golf on Saturday, and I have I guarantee you that I'm going to be using at least one excuse that my tolerance is off for any bad shot that I hit. God willing that the rain will
talk. One of those.
Okay, one of them. Perfect. Yeah. Listeners, we're talking to Michael Verska again. Obviously, a guy who's been on the show a few times. You know, Michael, another quick question for you. I mean, all this talk about the different tolerances and the measurement system and the products themselves, as well as all the work that goes into the R&D. You know, you were on here last time too, talking about golf shafts and how there's definitely no standard for measuring that either. But for the actual product testing before anybody even knows a club exists, how much testing goes into that? And I know that club releases can take multiple years in some instances. I mean, there was talk that Callaway was testing the Epic Flash Driver for a very long time before it even saw the light of day. From your experience, how much testing in terms of length of time are we talking about here?
So I would say on a minimum of, you're talking 6 months, an absolute minimum of 6 months, and that would be both robot and player. That would most likely be using different golf balls. You know, it's not uncommon. Again, I can't speak for every club company, but you would test, you know, the clubs with both your golf balls. And then if it's not the leader, you know, what would perform in some of the leading situations. You may even check it with, you know, a ball you hear is coming out and, hey, we're going to get something similar to that. So you'd be testing with both robots and players multiple times each. Hopefully multiple conditions, weather conditions. Let's test it when it's hot. Let's test it when it's just kind of medium warm. Are we getting any differences there? Are we getting players with different angles of attack? Are we getting players of, you know, all with a similar handicap? Again, if you're going for a better player group, you're going to be a low handicap, but are we getting players with different swing speeds in that low handicap range? Are we then correlating that to the robot data? What are we seeing? So again, from any of the major OEMs, you're talking a minimum of 6 months testing. Now, it's not nonstop because there'll have to be some iterations. Hey, we tested this. We need to make this tweak. Hey, we tested that. We need to make this other tweak. But it is, you know, when I say nonstop, meaning it continues on for, again, a minimum of 6 months, and quite frankly, 12 to 15 is not abnormal.
That's crazy.
Again, from a big OEM.
Right, right. And for the smaller ones, of course, the timeline just goes down, you know, because I'd imagine that they need to get product out there. And so that's the
Yeah, and again, they have less people to test it, right? If you have, you know, 5 or 8 people in your test group, you can do a lot more if you have 3 or 4 in your whole company.
Right, right. Of course. Definitely. Well, listeners, you know, we've talked a lot about a lot of different topics today. And Michael, obviously, we always appreciate you being able to come on. And we want to make this more frequent. You and I have talked about that. We want to bring you on back, time and time again to talk about different topics. And listeners, if you're listening to this and this has prompted more questions in your mind, please feel free to get a hold of either myself or Michael. You can find both of us on Twitter. Michael's available at VGolfMan on Twitter. And of course, you can reach out to me at GolfUnfiltered. And Michael, we'll kind of, you know, keep our eyes and ears open, see what people are talking about. You know, I know that they've sent you emails, me as well. And we can also check the forums over at thehackersparadise.com to get even more questions. And let's do this again soon.
Yeah, and hopefully we're still friends after Saturday's round of golf. I think we will be, but time will have to tell.
As long as the weather holds out, I think we'll be okay. I'm looking forward to it.
I am as well. Thanks, Adam.